You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Brookings Institution. I'm Bill Gale. It's my honor to welcome you to today's symposium on tax expenditures and the deficit, time to rethink retirement saving policy. And you'll note the question mark at the end. That's a question, not a statement. I want to thank you all for coming out on this very busy day in Washington. The reason for this event is fairly straightforward. Policymakers are, or they should be, looking for ways to shore up the nation's medium-term, long-term finances. They are, or they should be, looking for ways to reform the tax system. They are, or they should be, looking for ways to help the retirement preparedness of American households and the cost-effectiveness of alternative ways of reaching that goal. And the notion of reforming tax expenditures in general, not just retirement saving in particular, but all tax expenditures, is as close to a consensus as exists today in Washington on anything. President Obama called for tax reform of tax expenditures last night. He's called for it repeatedly. Congressional Republican and Democratic leaders have called for it repeatedly. Every commission on the fiscal situation that has issued a report has called for tax expenditure reform. So this morning we'll hear the results of a new paper on a particular tax expenditure that relating to retirement saving, and we'll look at the effects of automatic enrollment and tax incentives for retirement saving on retirement saving and on other forms of saving. Before we start, let me just mention a little housekeeping. Today's event is co-sponsored by the Retirement Security Project as well as the Tax Policy Center. RSP is a collaborative effort with David John of the Heritage Foundation as the deputy. TPC is a joint venture between the Urban Institute and the Brookings Institution. It's also a collaborative venture, of course, but we call it a joint venture. Donald Marin of Urban runs the TPC, but he could not attend this morning. Our event this morning will start with a presentation by Harvard professors Raj Shetty and John Friedman on their paper, which you have a summary of in your handout. After the presentation, we'll have comments from two people, Pete Parady of the Investment Company Institute and Andrew Biggs of the American Enterprise Institute. At that point, we'll all assemble up here. We'll talk amongst ourselves. We'll take questions from the audience. You have bios of everyone in your folder. You have a summary of the paper in your folder, so I won't introduce the speakers in any more detail than that, other than to say I'm extremely happy to have this lineup of people. We have the very best people here speaking on an incredibly important topic, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Raj and John and turn the podium over to them. Thank you.
So thank you very much for having us, and thank you all for coming. We'd especially like to thank the Brookings Institution and Bill for organizing this event. I think sometimes as academics we wonder whether anybody's actually ever reading our papers in policy circles, and it's wonderful the important role that I think Brookings plays in bringing academic research to bear on the policy debate. So the question that we're asking in this study is a very simple and we think important one in the context of the current policy debate, which is motivated by the fact that the U.S. spends a substantial amount, roughly $100 billion per year, on subsidies for retirement savings accounts such as 401ks and IRAs. And the goal of those subsidies is naturally to increase savings rates in the U.S., and especially among households that we might think are not adequately prepared for retirement, we'd like to raise their rates of savings. Now, what we do in this study is evaluate whether these subsidies, such subsidies, accomplish this goal of increasing savings rates. In particular, we ask whether tax subsidies encourage families to save more in total, or whether they simply induce shifting of assets into more tax advantage accounts. So when the retirement savings subsidy is larger, do I take money that I would have saved anyway in a bank account and put it in my 401k or my IRA in order to get a tax advantage? Now, that question, given its importance, naturally has attracted a lot of attention in the literature, with work going back at least 30 years by many prominent economists, including Glenn Hubbard, Bill Gale, Jim Peterba, and many others. And despite that extensive amount of research where I think scholars have done the best they can with available U.S. data, the answer, I think it's fair to say, remains quite highly debated, both among academics and policymakers. And the main problem is essentially that there's a lack of high-quality data on household savings in non-retirement accounts in the U.S. So it turns out that in the U.S., these past studies have had good information on retirement account balances. So, for instance, you can get pretty good administrative information on how much money a person has in, say, their Vanguard retirement accounts, to take an example. What is much more difficult to get information on is the complete portfolio of assets that a person has. How much money do you have in your other bank accounts, in your house? How much debt are you holding, and so forth? You don't really have a consolidated data system in the U.S. that's going to give you this type of information for a large number of people. And so as a result, identifying policy impacts on saving in non-retirement accounts has proven quite challenging for the U.S.-based literature. So what we do in this study is turn to a place where we can actually get very good data on household savings, which is Denmark. So it turns out that Denmark collects fantastic information on savings and a number of other outcomes, actually. And so in particular, we're going to use the universe of Danish income tax returns from 1994 to 2009. So this covers everyone in Denmark, so about 4.3 million people in our sample, and gives us 45 million observations on their savings as well as their debt in retirement accounts, non-retirement accounts, and so forth. You have a comprehensive picture of the balance sheet for 45 million households, which is the type of data you need, I think, in modern quasi-experimental empirical work in economics to get really precise answers to these questions. Now, importantly, this data on savings comes from third-party reports to the tax authority. So you should think of this as like Bank of America or Fidelity directly reporting to the IRS how much money you have in each of your accounts. And as a result, the information we think is quite reliable. There's very little measurement error and very little reporting error. Okay, so a very natural question when we mentioned that we're going to look at data from Denmark is whether U.S. policy should be informed by Danish data. Can we translate lessons that we obtain from the Danish data to the U.S. context? So we think we can. Naturally, you know, the ideal would be to study the U.S. itself, but we think that there's good reason that the types of lessons that we're finding here would translate to the U.S. context for three reasons. First, institutionally, the pension system in Denmark is quite similar in structure to the U.S. and many other developed countries. So there are three pillars to this pension system. First, there's a state-provided defined benefit plan. You can think of that as sort of analogous to the Social Security system in the U.S. There's an employer-provided defined contribution account system, which you can think of as analogous to 401ks. And then there are individual retirement accounts, which are analogous to IRAs. Now, importantly, for our study, the employer-provided defined contribution accounts and the individual retirement accounts are perfect substitutes for each other. That is, the set of investments you can make in each of these accounts is perfectly analogous, and so putting an extra dollar in your employer-provided account or your individual account is basically going to be equivalent, and you'll see why that's important for our analysis. The second point to keep in mind is that savings rates for working-age individuals in Denmark and the U.S. are broadly comparable. So it's not like these two countries have dramatically different savings patterns overall. And so you might think the Danish lessons might translate to the U.S. for that reason. But the third, and I think most important and most compelling reason in our view, is that policy impacts within retirement accounts, where we are able to study behavior well in the U.S., are very similar in Denmark and the U.S. in many, many dimensions. So, for instance, the impacts of subsidies that have been identified in prior work by Bill and others in the U.S. data are very similar to the impacts we see in the Danish data. The impacts of the types of automatic contributions and defaults that we're going to study are also very similar across the two countries. And in particular, we're going to find that the rate of passive behavior, which is a key theme of our study, looks quite similar within retirement accounts in the U.S. and Denmark. And so, in my view, it would be quite peculiar if it turns out that within retirement accounts, behavior is very similar across these two countries, but then somehow outside retirement accounts, Americans are totally different from the Danes. And so that, I think, is the strongest reason that you should be interested in these findings from a U.S. perspective. So here's a brief overview of what we do. We analyze two types of policies using quasi-experimental methods, essentially trying to generate an experiment in the data with the available variation, which I think is the gold standard of evidence in the modern social science literature. So the first type of policy that we study are automatic contributions by the government or by employers to workers' retirement savings accounts. And we'll talk more about the details of how those policies work in a little bit. The second type of policy is tax subsidy for retirement savings, very much like the subsidies we have in the U.S. for 401ks or IRAs. The main finding of the paper is that automatic contributions raise total savings much more than price subsidies. So for every dollar that you get people to put in automatically through these defaults or automatic enrollment procedures, you end up raising the total amount they save much more than what you would achieve if you put in a subsidy. Now, in order to give you a little bit of intuition for why you get that result, sort of a simple conceptual framework, we're going to interpret that result through a model of active versus passive savers. And so I'd just like to talk through that for a minute in order to lay a groundwork for the presentation. So let's start with the first policy, the automatic contribution, which is, for instance, think about you work at an employer who defaults you into contributing 3% of your paycheck into a 401k plan. So what is that going to do to your savings behavior? Let's take two different types of savers, people who I'm going to call active savers, who behave according to the predictions of traditional economic models, who are fully optimizing. Okay, so the first question I want to ask is, if I put in this 3% default contribution, is that going to affect the total amount that this individual is contributing to the pension? And I want you to think about a person who was already saving more than 3%, already putting more than 3% in their pension. So, of course, if that person was not saving at all before, if they were at a corner, then if I make you save 3%, I'm going to mechanically increase the amount that you save. That's not the case that we're interested in, either theoretically or empirically throughout this paper. So we deal with this issue of corners throughout. Instead, what I want you to focus on is a person who's able to cut back and undo whatever the employer is doing. All right. So let's say you were previously saving 4%, and now I introduce this 3% automatic contribution by the employer. If you're a fully rational, optimizing individual, what should you do? You should reduce the amount that you were contributing one for one so that you end up still at the 4% desired savings rate where you were before, right? And so we would predict that the traditional optimizing model would say that active savers are totally unaffected by these automatic contributions. They don't change the amount they're contributing to pension accounts, and they don't change the total amount that they save. In contrast, a set of people whom we're going to call passive savers are, think of them as basically being inattentive to what's going on in their pension plan. So these are people who might not be paying attention to the details of government policy or what exactly their employer is putting in. And as we've seen in the U.S. evidence, they're highly influenced by the defaults as a result. They don't bother going and undoing what the firm has done or what the government has done. And so as a result, when I put in the 3% automatic contribution, I do raise pension contributions for these passive savers. But it's unclear whether I raise their total savings. That depends, so this box here is uncertain, that depends upon the way in which people adjust to the fact that their disposable income has gone down. So suppose I take 3% of your pay and put it in this retirement account. Now you have 3% less money. You can do one of two things. You can either cut back the amount that you consume, or you can cut back the amount that you save, say, in your bank account, because your income has now fallen and you continue to spend exactly what you were doing before. In that second case, we're going to again find no impact on total savings, even though you're completely inattentive to what the employer is doing, simply because you just run down your bank balance as the employer puts more of your money in a pension. And so it's an empirical question, and this is the key question that we can answer with the Danish data, where we have the full balance sheet. We can actually tell whether these defaults are raising total savings. That is not a question we've been able to answer in the past with U.S. data. So that's the automatic contribution. Now let's quickly run through the impacts of the tax subsidy. So for passive savers, The tax subsidy, by definition, is going to have no impact. These are people who are not paying attention to any government policy. And so when you change the size of the subsidy, it doesn't affect their behavior in pensions or in non-pension accounts. For active savers, we do think you'd contribute more to the pension when the subsidy goes up because you just want to take advantage of the fact that you have a higher subsidy. But that money that you put into these pension accounts could either come from consuming less, in which case total savings goes up, or it could come from shifting money that you would have saved in the bank into these tax-advantaged accounts, in which total savings would not go up. And so, again, this key question of total savings impacts, which has been very difficult to answer in the U.S. data, is one that we will be able to answer with precision in these Danish data. And so the structure of this talk, you can think of it essentially as, you know, you see the answers differ based on whether we have active or passive savers, and we just want to fill in these question marks. What is actually true empirically? So here's an outline of how we're going to structure the presentation. We'll first talk about the impacts of tax subsidies, then about the impacts of automatic contribution policies, and then we'll show you why the mechanism here really seems to be one of active versus passive choice. And that mechanism, we think, is very likely to translate to the U.S. And so then we'll conclude by discussing policy lessons. So I'm going to turn it over to John, who will talk about the impacts of tax subsidies.
Great. So what I want to start by doing is walking you through the evidence that we present in the paper on the impacts of tax subsidies on both savings in pension accounts and outside. And to do so, I need to tell you a little bit more about the details of the institutional setup in Denmark. There are actually two different parallel types of retirement savings accounts that individuals and firms can contribute to. One is a capital pension, which pays out as a lump sum upon retirement and gets taxed at a fixed rate that's roughly equal to the lowest marginal income tax rate. And then, on the other hand, there are annuity pensions, which are converted into an annuity either somewhere between 10 and 25 years at retirement, and then as they get paid out are taxed as income. Now, the policy change that we're going to analyze was a change in the government subsidy for the capital pension that occurred in 1999. And I'm going to tell you specifically what happened there, but there was no change in the annuity account at that time. So before this change occurred, this is the way that the tax system worked for contributions to this capital pension plan. So at the time of contribution, you paid no tax on the money that you contributed, very similar to the U.S. There were capital gains along the way, although this is a much lower number than you would pay for capital gains in your Vanguard portfolio. So there was a subsidy along the way here. And then you paid a flat 40% tax upon payout, which, again, is equal to about the lowest level of marginal tax rate in Denmark. Now, in 1999 and thereafter, both of these two boxes here remained the same, and the only thing that changed is that you had to pay 14% extra tax at the time of contribution if you were an income earner in the top tax bracket. And so all this stuff is staying the same, so in some sense this is a pure reduction in the government subsidy. And we estimate that the government subsidy fell from about 35 cents on the dollar to 20 or 21 cents on the dollar as a result of this. Now, what this generates is a research design where here I've plotted, you know, think about the cross-section of Danes who are earning different amounts of income. This dashed line in the middle is the boundary between the middle tax bracket and the top tax bracket. It's at about $45,000 in U.S. dollars. And for this group over here that were treated, the subsidy fell from a higher rate down to this lower rate in 1999, whereas for those who were just below this threshold, there was no change in the subsidy. So I think the first thing you might want to do is we're just going to look at average contributions to this capital pension plan across this exact same income range in the years before and after this change was made. So previously, this is the plot for 1996. We see that, you know, people who earn more save more. And this is a very consistent graph in 97 and then 98 as well. But then in 1999, when the reform comes in, the level of contribution sharply falls for those people who were affected by the reform. And then it stays at this lower rate consistently through 2001. So if you compare these two lines, there was roughly a 50% reduction in the total aggregate contributions, annual contributions to this capital pension plan, which is quite a lot. It maps to the responsiveness that we see among U.S. pension savers, for instance, in response to a change in the match rate that a firm gives to its employees. But what's really striking here is that this very large fall was accounted for by a very small number of people. And so to show you that, I want to show you the change, the distribution of changes to pension accounts year on year. So let me explain what this graph is. This is the year before the pension change, so we can get a sense of what this looks like. So this very large spike at zero means that all these people made no change to their capital pension contributions from one year to the next. They just rolled it over. This smaller spike at minus 100, those are people who went from whatever they were contributing all the way down to zero, so a minus 100% change, and then there's a distribution of people otherwise. Now, as I said, this is what it looks like the year before the reform. In the year of the reform, we don't see most people reducing by a little bit. What we see is a few people going from not changing their contribution at all to entirely exiting. So what happened was 17 extra percent of people chose to entirely drop their capital pension contributions. And in the paper, you know, you can go through a more rigorous accounting exercise to show that this 17% of people accounts for all of the aggregate change in contributions to capital pensions. And the reason that such a small fraction of people can do that is that they were making much larger contributions before, and some of them were even going to increase their contributions, and instead of doing that, went to zero instead. So this entire change is being driven by this very small fraction of the population. That echoes what Raj talked about earlier. We think these 17% of people are the active people, whereas most of these people over here that do exactly what they would have done without the reform, they're acting in a way as though they just aren't paying attention. They don't notice the fact that this subsidy has fallen by a tremendous amount. So now, the key question that we want to focus in this paper is what happens to this money that comes out of the capital pension account. So about half of it goes into the other pension account, annuities, but half of it comes out of the total pension contributions. And so the question is, does that amount of money that comes out, does that go into extra consumption so that savings falls, or does it just go into your Vanguard portfolio and get saved in any case? And so to look at that, I'm going to use a similar plot like this. And what I'm going to look at is the rate at which people save more when they earn more money. And so what this is saying is that in the middle tax bracket, there is one rate, and then when we get into the top tax bracket, this is the plot before the reform took place. People who are in the top tax bracket contribute significantly more to the pensions for each extra $1,000 that they earn. And that makes sense. The pension plan beforehand is more advantageous for this group of people. And what we're just going to do is compare the rate at which people are contributing to this pension plan before to after. And you can see that this line up here is much more, much less steeply sloped than the year before. And in particular, the difference between the contribution rates of those who are affected by the reform and those who are not affected by the reform falls quite a bit. So before the reform, people in the top tax bracket are contributing an extra 1.7% of income to their pensions, whereas afterwards it's only 0.7%. And so we can represent this on a graph by showing you that beforehand the contribution rate was here and then it fell quite sharply. So this is the causal impact of the reform on contributions to pension plans. Again, this maps to what we see in the U.S. What we can do in these data is plot this exact same curve for contributions to taxable savings accounts like bank accounts and Vanguard. And what we see is exactly the opposite pattern. People who were above this tax bracket and who experienced this drop in the subsidy sharply increased the rate right in 1999 at which they contribute to their Vanguard account or their bank account. And so what's going on is that people are taking money out of their pensions and they're just putting it right back into their Vanguard account. And so you can work out, again, the accounting. So what we find is that about 10 Danish kroner come out of the pension account. Now you have to pay tax on that. You're paying tax at the beginning, not the end. So you end up with 4 Danish kroner left. And 3.92 is deposited in the taxable savings account. And consumption only increases by this very small 0.808 kroner. And so what this is saying is that 98% of the change in pension contributions due to the subsidies is just a switch from one type of savings account to the other. It's not changing the total amount that people are saving. And based on this account, we can also ask a different question. We can say, well, of the money that the government spends subsidizing this account, what fraction of that ends up as an increase in total savings? And the answer is, for each dollar that they spend, less than 1 cent ends up as additional savings. And again, the reason is that mostly the subsidy is just getting people to switch money from one account to another. It's not actually getting them to save anymore. So we can fill in this final row down here in the data. Yes, tax subsidies affect pension contributions. That's consistent with the U.S. evidence. But no, the subsidies do not affect total saving. And so that's the first important finding from this paper that we'll return to later to think about the policy consequences for the U.S. So now I want to talk about automatic contributions. Now here, we're going to use a different design. And in the paper, we actually have two designs that look at this. We look at changes in employer contributions and also a government mandate to see whether that changed savings rates. We find very similar results from each approach. So I'm just going to focus for simplicity here on the first. And the idea is to study the impacts of changes in employer contributions when you switch jobs. So the idea is that I'm working at Harvard, which contributes, say, 2% of my income to a pension plan, and then, say, I contribute another 2% of my income to a pension plan. Now suppose I move to Yale, and Yale instead contributes 4% of my income to a pension plan. Now, if I want to maintain my pension savings in total at 4%, all I need to do is cut my own individual contributions from zero, from 2 down to 0, and I'm basically identically off to where I was before. And importantly, in Denmark, the assets to which you can allocate your money are identical between the employer contributions and the individual contributions. They come from different sources, but once they're in the account, they look identical. And so let me walk you through what happens when somebody goes through exactly this type of switch. So I'm plotting an event study around the time of this switch, which occurs at this dashed line, and we found people who are going along, they switch jobs, have a big increase in employer pensions, and then that increase lasts. So this is the treatment that these people are exposed to. So now if I plot not just employer pension contributions, but total pension contributions, that is including the individual contributions, we see a very, very similar pattern. At the same time, when employer contributions go up, individual contributions basically don't fall at all. And so total pension contributions goes up by quite a bit. Now, to echo a point that Raj made earlier, in this plot, I'm cutting on people who were making positive contributions at this period right before the firm switch. So the vast, vast majority of people in this plot, about 90% of people in this plot, are not at the corner. And I'll show you some evidence in a second that has no people at a corner to worry about. This is a line that we could have plotted in the U.S. What we can do in the Danish data is plot total savings, both inside and outside the pension accounts. And here you see the exact same pattern. Total savings increases sharply exactly when this employer contribution increases, and then it stays high. And so I want to point out a couple things from this plot. First of all, you might think that the people who switch jobs and have this really large employer pension increases, maybe they're not like other people. Maybe they really wanted to increase their pension contributions, and this was just their way of doing it. And so I think that's unlikely for two reasons here. First, we don't see any movement in the years beforehand. You know, you might think that somebody starts to save a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more, and then finally they make it to a job where the contributions are higher. We don't see any of that movement before this large shift. It's really a very sharp shift in increase in the pensions. And then furthermore, there's no fall afterwards. It's not that people, sure, I can't get around to changing my savings this year, but in the next year or the year after, I eventually get back to where I wanted to be. This is a permanent increase in the individual savings rate when they make this switch. Now, second of all, I want to plot, just to totally convince you that we're not getting this mechanical effect from corners, I want to show you the fraction of people who are actually contributing 0% to their pensions. So it's about 60%. That's a lot, very similar to the United States as well. If people were trying to offset their employer pension change as much as they could, you would expect when they get a big increase in employer pension contributions, this number should increase a lot. Right? So say I'm contributing 2%, my employer goes up by 3%, well, I can't offset it all, but I'm going to run my 2% all the way down to zero. I'm going to go as far as I can go. And in fact, what the data predict, if people were using this offsetting behavior, is that you'd see a very large increase in the fraction of people who were exactly at this zero contribution level right when they switched. And in fact, we don't see that at all. The data are totally constant. And you can repeat this with any threshold. You can ask what fraction of people are saving above 1%, above 2%. You can do anything, and it's all just totally constant. And the reason is, let me just switch here, this is a distribution of changes to your private pension contributions from year to year. The vast majority of people are just doing nothing, right? It's not like people are subtly reoptimizing from one thing to the next. They're just not paying attention. They contribute exactly the same after they move to a new firm as before they move to the firm. And, you know, of course, there are some people who are changing that they would have changed anyway, but we only estimate from our data that roughly 15% of people are paying attention to this change in a way that the traditional model would suggest. So how do we show that? We can just take the difference in savings rates from before to after the change was made and plot that against the difference in the employer contributions, and you get this nice scatter plot where the slope of 90% tells you that for each extra dollar that the employer contributes to my pension account, my own savings go up by 90 cents. So an increase in these employer contributions or an increase in a default, for instance, is a very effective way to raise savings. A final thing that I just want to rule out is that if the employer increases their own pension contributions, we are giving you a little bit more money at the end of the day, right? So maybe you just wanted to save more money. You didn't have the money before, but now you do have the money. Suppose you're saving, you just really want to save a lot on the margin. And so what we can look at instead of people who are getting these increases in employer pension contributions, take people who are getting similarly sized increases in compensation, but where the compensation is coming in the form of a wage increase. And we can ask, what fraction of that wage increase do these people save? And the answer is a very small amount. Only about 10% of a wage increase is saved. Again, that looks very similar to numbers that we've estimated in the U.S. and other countries. But the form of this compensation really matters. You don't save wage increases, but if we put it in a pension account or force you to put it in a pension account, we can have a really big impact on your savings. And so, again, over the long term, how does this work out? Well, it turns out that people, by not responding, these changes can really add up over time. So here, we can look at the actual retirement wealth, both inside and outside your pension account, that you accrue by the time you get to age 60, which is the early retirement age in Denmark. People down here who saw large decreases in their employer pension contributions, after 10 or 15 years, end up with almost an entire year's worth less of wealth than the people over here that experienced a big increase in this employer contribution. So these things can really add up over time and make an enormous difference for the amount of wealth that somebody has left over when they start to think about retirement. So based on this evidence, I'm going to fill in these two data boxes behind Raj's head here with a yes. Yes, these defaults increase total pension contributions. Again, we think we knew that from the U.S., and it's good to confirm that in these data. And second, those increases in the pension account look like they really carry through to total savings. And as a final point I want to make before I turn it back over to Raj to move towards policy conclusions, a natural question is there an interaction between these two policies, right? Maybe people are willing to accept these employer pension contributions just as a contribution to savings only because they're getting a tax subsidy in those accounts. And so we've actually looked at the interaction between exactly these two policies that I've described. We can ask, are people more likely to accept the increase in saving from their employer contribution or in that earlier regime where they were getting a much higher subsidy or in the later regime where they were getting a much lower subsidy? And we don't find any interaction in the data. The pass-through is identical in each case. And so, again, it's hard to say what would happen if we entirely eliminated the subsidy, but reducing the subsidy from, call it, 35 cents on the dollar to 20 cents on the dollar seemed to have no impact on their willingness to accept these defaults. And so with that, let me turn it back to Raj to move towards policy calculations.
Right, great. So we've presented the core evidence of the paper showing that these two policies have very different impacts. And before we now turn to policy implications, we want to show you a little bit about what we think the key mechanism is that's driving the different impacts. So why do automatic contributions and subsidies have such different impacts on total savings, as John discussed? As I said, I think it's very important to understand the mechanism to determine if the results will apply in the U.S., because if, you know, this active versus passive choice mechanism is at play, you'd have to argue that there's a very different set of active savers or people are more attentive in the U.S. in order for the results to look very different. That's why I think this is quite crucial. So our hypothesis for, as we've been saying, for the difference in the impacts of these two policies is that automatic contributions affect the behavior of these passive savers who are not paying attention to the employer or government policies, whereas the subsidy, if you think about who is going to be able to respond to a subsidy, it's the attentive type of person who actually is aware of the changes in the tax code and is thinking about their retirement savings and so forth. So in order to test whether that's actually the mechanism that's at play, we analyzed variation in responses across individuals. Now, as we've shown you a couple of times, roughly 15% of individuals respond actively to both policies. So we found that 17% of individuals changed their contributions when the subsidy was reduced in 1999, and we found that somewhere around 15% or maybe a little less offset their employer pension changes when the employer increases their contribution. Only about 15% of people do something to offset that. So what I want to ask now is, who are these 15% of people who seem to be responding actively, and who are the 85% of people who seem not to be paying attention? So the first way that we look at this is think about a very intuitive definition of who an active saver is. We, on the x-axis here, is the fraction of other years in which people change their pension contribution. So basically think of this as a measure of how often you update your pension contributions. So somebody who's totally inattentive, we'd expect them to be on the far left-hand side of the scale where every year I do the same exact thing. I'm not really paying attention to my retirement plans. Somebody on the far right, they're constantly changing the amount that they contribute or changing their portfolio allocation. And so they're who we're going to call active savers. As you move to the right of this graph, you get people who are more actively managing their retirement portfolio. Now, on the y-axis is one measure of the degree of response to that subsidy change. So in particular, what that y variable is the fraction of people who completely exited the capital pension. As John described, that was the main mode of response, that about 15% of people completely stopped contributing to that account once the subsidy went down. And so each dot tells you the fraction of people in that group on the x-axis who are responding in this way to the capital pension subsidy. And what you can see is that there's a very clear upward-sloping relationship, namely the people who we think, based on this intuitive definition, are more actively managing their portfolios are also the ones who are responding more actively, as we'd expect, according to the traditional economic model, to the subsidy change by reducing the amount they contribute to pensions and shifting that money into bank accounts. Now, conversely, we can ask, are the people who are active savers, the people on the right side, are they less responsive to the changes in employer pensions? So unfortunately, the y-axis label is cut off, but what it says is it's passed through of employer pensions to total pensions, meaning for every dollar that the employer puts in your pension account, how much do you raise your savings? And remember, an active optimizer would basically undo what the employer is doing. And here, as you'd predict, you get a downward sloping relationship. The guys who are more actively managing their portfolios are also more likely to undo whatever changes the employer is making. The people on the left who are totally inattentive, they just go along with whatever the employer is doing. So that looks very much like a model of active versus passive choice, right? That the same set of people who are responding to the subsidy are also undoing the employer's automatic contributions, and that it's correlated with the degree of active optimization of your portfolios. Now, the next set of things we're going to do and the last set of results we'll show is giving you a more concrete picture of who these active savers are. What types of people are these active savers? So the simplest thing to look at is wealth-income ratios. This is a simple measure of how much you're saving or how much you're saving for, in particular, for retirement, right? How much money have you accumulated planning for your retirement? And so people on the right side here are better prepared for retirement in the sense of having a higher wealth-income ratio. And again, we're going to show you the same two outcomes on the y-axis. This first outcome here is the degree of response to the subsidy. And what you can see very clearly is that the people who are not preparing much for retirement, who are not saving very much, are very unresponsive to that subsidy change. The people who have accumulated a lot of savings, this is outside retirement accounts, in their bank accounts, these high wealth income ratio people are much more likely to respond actively to these subsidies. So this strikes me as quite intuitive, right? The people who are focused on retirement planning, are accumulating wealth, those are exactly the types of guys who are going to respond to the subsidy. But think about the implications of that for policy. A subsidy change, we want it at some level, I think, to affect the savings behavior of the people who are least prepared for retirement. That is the people on the left side of this graph. But unfortunately, the subsidy does exactly the opposite. It affects the people who are already saving quite a bit. They're the most attentive ones, and that makes sense. In contrast, if you look at the automatic contribution, the impacts of the employer pension changes, it's exactly the reverse. That has a big impact for people with low wealth income ratios, the types of people who are inattentive, and much smaller impacts for people who are better prepared for retirement. Another dimension on which you can cut the data is by age. So this shows you in the blue bars here the degree of response to the subsidy by age bins. And you can see that people who are older, maybe because they're closer to retirement or just because they're wiser, are more responsive to the subsidy change. And likewise, they are more likely to offset the employer pension contributions. That is, each dollar of employer pension contributions has smaller impacts on total savings for older people, which also, I think, I would argue, seems consistent with the model of attention and active versus passive choice. And then the final cut we do is the Danish data. As I said, they collect incredible data. You know what courses people took in high school and in college and even what grades they got and so forth. And so you can see that a college education makes you more likely to respond, but perhaps even better, if you're an economics-trained person, you're more likely to respond to the subsidy. You're more likely to be an active saver. So where does this bring us? Where does all this evidence bring us? We'll wrap up in the last few minutes here by talking about policy implications. So first, let's talk about the direct policy lessons from the data as they apply to the Danish context, where there's no issue of extrapolating to a different environment. So here, we think it's clear that tax subsidies are ineffective at raising savings for three reasons. First, you're spending a tremendous amount of money subsidizing the savings of 85% of people who do not respond at all. So in economics jargon, this is an inframarginal transfer to 85% of people whose behavior you're not affecting. Second, even among the 15% of people who do respond, the type of response you get is largely a shifting from the pension accounts, from non-retirement savings to these pension accounts when you increase these subsidies. And so you're not really having that much of a net impact on total savings, even for the 15% who bother to do something. And third, as I was saying earlier, in some sense you target the wrong people. The active savers are already saving at higher rates, and so the subsidies don't really influence the behavior of the people who are least prepared for retirement. In contrast, automatic contributions directly resolve exactly those three problems. They increase savings substantially precisely because they do not require active choice by individuals, and they target individuals who have lower savings rates, who are these more passive types. Now, let's come to the U.S. So what does it take to translate those policy lessons to the U.S.? I think there are two key issues. First, are American and Danish households similar? And second, are American and Danish institutions similar? So do people have similar preferences? And is the institutional structure similar enough across the two economies that we'd expect the results to extend to the U.S.? So let's take the first question. So, of course, there are differences between Danish people and Americans. I think Danes are supposed to be happier and they might be taller and so forth. That's obviously not the point. The key question is whether the degree of passive behavior, which is really the core of our finding here, right? That's the key mechanism, is similar in the U.S. And here, fortunately, we do actually have very good evidence from prior work showing that the degree of passive behavior within retirement accounts is, in fact, quite similar to what we've shown you in the Danish data. So that, in my mind, is the single strongest piece of evidence that this active versus passive mechanism is very important in the U.S. and that these results are, at least qualitatively, going to extend to the U.S. The second issue, are American and Danish retirement savings institutions similar? Yes, as we've talked about at the beginning, with one important exception that I want to highlight here, which is a caveat. Access to retirement savings accounts is mostly dependent on employers in the U.S., unlike in Denmark. Okay, so in the U.S., if your employer doesn't offer a 401k plan, you can't contribute to a 401k account. And so you might worry in the U.S. that if we cut back on subsidies, that could affect access to 401ks for workers, something that would not happen in Denmark, given the way their system is set up, independent of employers. Now, that is a legitimate concern, but our view is that a small tax credit for firms should likely be adequate to ensure that firms continue to offer access to such accounts. So it's not clear that you need a subsidy, particularly run through the income tax system with larger subsidies for high-income individuals, in order to get employers to just offer these accounts. Second, and more broadly, there's no obvious reason to tie retirement savings to firms, right? For instance, the government could raise IRA limits and allow payroll deductions when you contribute to IRAs in a way that's totally independent from firms, and so it's not obvious that you really need to view this as a fundamental concern if you were to change the subsidy. So to wrap up, what are the bottom line policy implications for the U.S. based on this evidence, if you're willing to extrapolate from Denmark to the U.S.? We think the findings call into question whether the existing subsidies are the most cost-effective way to raise savings rates. We think that alternative policies that expand existing institutions that we already have in the U.S. could raise savings rates significantly while reducing government expenditure. So what might some of those elements be? We might want to expand defaults and automatic enrollment, which we have at many firms already in the U.S., and maybe the government could potentially do more of this. We might want to allow automatic payroll deductible contributions to IRAs, kind of giving that convenient feature where you don't have to think about it and the money goes into the IRA year after year. Finally, you might still want to have a small tax credit or deduction to give incentives to employers to encourage automatic enrollment and offering of such policies. So we'll leave it there, and we're very much looking forward to your comments and questions.
Hello. Thanks to Bill and David for inviting me to talk. Appreciate it. And thanks for a very interesting paper with data that doesn't exist in the U.S. The type of administrative data that Denmark have is pretty amazing. Also want to preface my, the two caveats. One, these are my opinions and not those of ICI or its members. I didn't even know what I was going to say until about 5 minutes ago, so no one's checked this. Secondly, I'm no expert on the Danish pension system, but I did stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night, so we'll see how it goes. All right, so obviously the authors are great presenters. I don't need to summarize their results for you. It's a very long paper, and there's many results, so I may have focused on ones, different ones, and got slightly different impression. So they do find an offset between mandated savings increases and individual savings accounts. And my reading of the paper, I thought it was just individual savings accounts and not employee contributions to employer plans, but you can correct me if I'm wrong. So the main switch is from these individual savings accounts and mandated savings. The change in the tax treatment has impact, but it's shifted between accounts. I guess I was focusing on some of the results that weren't presented that had to do with the 1% increase in mandated savings, where they talked about the problems with their measure of household. They actually don't have a measure of household savings, at least from my measure. They have a measure of household assets and liabilities, may be able to construct wealth. In vernacular, savings and wealth are interchangeable, but one's a flow and one's a stock. And changes in wealth are very variable and don't necessarily translate. But again, I could be wrong in that if they actually have flows into bank accounts or other things. I may have missed that. So the author's conclusions and the key assumptions, again, these aren't new to the authors. They spend most of the paper dealing with these issues. It's real important to know whether people are at a corner or not. So basically, if people are, say, already have too much in pension savings and you change the incentives, they won't adjust, or they have a lot of other savings outside of pensions already, changing the incentives may have different adjustments. The other thing is that savings in individual accounts and mandated savings are close substitutes. Based on my extensive research using Google and reading OECD documents, I got a different impression of this, but I'm happy to be corrected if I'm wrong, that these things aren't necessarily perfect substitutes. And then the other one is that Denmark's like the U.S. Okay, so my discussion is, I'm going to talk a little bit, main points will be Denmark's not like the U.S. Mandatory savings and savings in individual accounts, I think, are unlikely to be close substitutes, but again, it could be my misreading of OECD documents, so I'm more than willing to be corrected on that. I have questions about the data they show on job change. So the one of their experiments is when people change jobs and there's exogenous changes in savings, how do they react? The tax treatment in Denmark is different than that in the U.S. And then, if I have time, conclude on a few remarks about the U.S. system. Oh, okay. So I think I may have lost my animation, but that's okay. You can read while I'm trying to make my joke. But essentially, I mean, there are some obvious ways Denmark's not like the U.S. You know, 5.5 million people, 90% are Danish descent, so it's a little bit less like the United States and maybe more like Wisconsin with less ethnic diversity. It has a much higher tax rate, so the 60% marginal tax rate hits at about $70,000 U.S. according, I don't know what year that is, quite honestly, or what interest rate. There may be somewhere around there, relatively low compared to the U.S., whatever the right number is. And also taxes as a percent of GDP are 50% of, taxes are 50% of GDP at all levels. Now, that said, actually those differences aren't really what I'm concerned about. In many ways, Denmark is very similar. They have a similar age distribution, similar labor force participation. And although they have very high taxes, the Heritage Foundation's freedom rank ranks them actually higher than the U.S. So apparently they have, you know, relatively open markets and are that economy. So that's not what I'm concerned about. What I'm concerned about is the pension system like the U.S. And again, based on my reading of the OECD documents, which I'm happy to be corrected on, it doesn't appear to be. So first, the universal pension, which is a government pension, it's a pay-as-you-go pension. Is it similar to Social Security? And the answer is no. So Social Security is a progressive system. It replaces a higher percent of pay for lower lifetime incomes than for higher lifetime incomes. But actually, as your lifetime earnings go up, the absolute amount of Social Security benefits actually goes up over time. The Danish pension system let's assume you're not working anymore because there's some earnings tests, but it's essentially a flat benefit that goes down as income from other sources goes up. Okay, so it's different. And there's no dedicated source of funding. It's funded out of general revenue. Whether you consider that a difference or not is probably philosophical. The defined contribution plans, there's two. There's a government, I don't know if it's local governments or it's a mandated savings that goes into accounts called ATP. It's a flat amount per work. It's based on hours you work, and it's a flat amount. And then there's the occupational pensions. And then there's individual accounts. Individual accounts probably are pretty close to IRAs. They seem to be about the same income limits, depending on interest rates or depending on exchange rates. But I would say the occupational schemes are not the same. And again, this is my reading of OECD documents. So the occupational schemes are not, they're defined contribution plans. They're not, according to these, there's no choice involved. They're compulsory. Okay, so 90% of full-time workers, according to the OECD, are in Denmark, are governed by a collective bargaining agreement, and those set the rates of employer and employee contributions. And typically it's one-third employees, two-thirds employer. And what it was described as, or maybe this was just a labor market, I think this was written by a labor union guy, so maybe it's not universal, but the collective bargaining agreement set how much you save based on how much you make, okay? And so at least that's what the description was. They said white-collar employees were about 50%, 9% for others. The DC plan doesn't mean individual control, although I'm sure this is changing over time and there may be different groups, but again, the description I read was an agreement-based benefit with collective sharing of investment risk. Now, quite honestly, I don't know exactly what that means, but what I took away from it is it's sort of like sort of a defined benefit plan without a defined benefit. There's a formula, and they adjust it based on how well the fund does over time, and there's risk employees. And annuity payment is prominent in the descriptions, but I have absolutely no idea how many of these are paid out as annuities and how, if annuity means a life annuity or if it's a 10-year payout or so forth. Okay, so what I did is I did a calculation I do for the U.S. system based on my, again, extensive reading of Wikipedia, but not the text, the actual, yeah, I went to the sources, so I'm fine, and tried to model the tax system and what the benefits were, and looked at people that sort of moderate income and then higher income. And so a middle, and I changed everything to U.S. dollars. Again, I used the spot interest rate today, which is probably wrong, or actually 2 days ago. But in any event, so don't look at the general, the numbers may be a little off, but just get the sense. So I'm expressing this all in U.S. dollars, thousands of U.S. dollars. So this person's making about $38,000. That's their gross income while they're working, and I'm assuming they only have earnings. They don't have any other income. They get a basic – when they retire, they get a basic benefit. They get the targeted benefit. It's about $20,000. ATP, based on an estimate – the formula is actually quite weird for the ATP, but this is the mandatory system is 4.5. And then assuming that they're putting in 3% and the employer is putting in 6% and using rate of return assumptions, that's about 10.5 thousand. After you pay taxes while you're working, you pay there's an 8% social contribution, which pays for health care. You got your contributions to the occupational pension, your contributions to the ATP, and then you have taxes. You got about 22,000 left over. Retired worker after taxes, they don't have to pay the health care tax. They're not saving anymore, so they just pay taxes. They get a replacement rate of net income about 98%. Take someone making about 80 grand, and they're while they're working, when they're retired, they get a basic pension of 11. Their target, it goes way down because it's means tested, and so they have too much other income to get the full amount of the target, so that goes way down. That's a 30% clawback rate. They get the ATP of the same amount. Oh, and the scales are off, by the way. I just they're two different charts. They're not the same scale. Then they have a much more income from their occupational pension because they make more money and they're putting in 15% overall, 5 and 10, 5 from them, 10 from the employer. So you look at their net income while working. They got their social contribution. They have their contributions to the plan that they're saving. The ATP, the taxes, they made that 39.8. And then you have tax at 36.7. They got a 94 replacement rate. So and all these are, from my understanding, these are mandated. They don't have a choice over this. So the question is, who needs to supplement this much savings with additional savings in these individual accounts of about $5,000 a year? Because you've already mandated, presumably, the labor market agreements. They're trying to set this at the right level. Now, if you don't believe my simulations based on my reading of Wikipedia, OECD does simulations that are actually quite similar. And what this is the replacement rates. This is a gross replacement rate, so it's not accounting for taxes or contributions. It's gross income. And the bottom scale is percent of average wages. So one is the average wage, and you go up and down. So they don't. For very low wage workers, presumably that chart's going to go even higher. And so they get very high replacement rates, around it. It's over 100% replacement rate and then goes down. So I think my back of the envelope simulations are probably roughly close. All right, is mandatory savings a close substitute for savings in an individual account? And this is where I'm more than open to being illuminated that I'm wrong in this. But one question is, why aren't most Danish people at a corner? I mean, don't they have enough from all the mandated savings? Why are they who are these people that need to save more? Now, I have a different number. I got it from the one of your tables that had percent of the sample who contribute to an individual account, so that might be wrong, might be the wrong measure, but it said 27% contribute to an individual account. So who are these people, or is there incessant need to add to the mandated savings they already have? And now, I don't understand the difference between the capital pensions and the annuity pensions. But it sounded like the capital pensions have a little more control over the investments. I don't know if that's the case. Is part of the desire for it some desire to control it? And again, I don't know how much control they can have in the occupational schemes. The stuff from the labor union suggests you don't have much control, but it could be wrong. I think questions are later. Can we leave? I mean, of course, we leave for the discussion because it's a good question. It's economic jargon. We all know what it means, but if I don't know if anyone else does. But that would be a very good question to answer. It essentially means like if you're already saving enough to replace 100% of your income, you might not be very responsive to incentives to save more. For example, you're already saving enough. Now, if they're not a substitute, this 1% mandatory, which, again, they actually didn't talk about in the presentation, but it's in the paper, there's this other experiment where there's an increase of 1% mandatory. It goes into the ATP, and if control is an issue, then it may not be a complete substitute. And the other thing is, again, they didn't talk about it in the presentation, but they do some tests around that there's not everyone is hit by this 1% mandate, but that it sort of kicks in at $6,000 of income, and they look at, I think, contributions to pensions. Maybe it's something else, but who's making $6,000 a year with all the different pension schemes in Denmark and still saving in this sixth individual account? So this is more questions on the job change results. Again, the identification and the job changes, you move from job to job, and there's an exogenous change in your contribution amount. And again, just coming from the description of what the OECD says, how do you get these exogenous changes? 90% are covered by a collective bargaining agreement. The description was they set the contribution rate based on your earnings. Again, there's probably some other variation in there that is not captured by this description. So I'm just interested in where that comes from. So if it's a correct, is it a correct description? Is it incorrect characterization? And if it is correct, where's the variation come from? Are there different occupational pensions? So some have more investment control and some have less. That might be a better measure, if you could control for that and see that those people, don't have this effect, it might be more convincing evidence than if control is a big issue, that people want to control their investments. All right, so this next topic should be quick. I wrote a paper on the topic, and I presented it to tax economists, and it took an hour, and not everyone, got it. So I'm not going to explain everything in it, but the U.S. tax treatment is deferral of tax, so there's no tax on labor when it's earned, there's no tax on investment returns, and everything's taxed on the way out, okay? The benefit of deferral is not the upfront deduction, okay? I guess one simple way to understand that is think about, suppose you weren't subject to any early withdrawal penalties, you put money in, you take it out, did you benefit at all in a deferred account? And the answer is no. So if you're at 35% bracket, you get a $35 deduction, but then the next day when you take it out, you're taxed $35. So they wipe each other out. The benefit comes from deferring. So the longer you keep an investment, the more benefits you get. And so the benefit isn't the upfront deduction. In Denmark, well, so I actually prepared some comparative stats and had some really nice charts based on what I assumed the system worked, and then I reread the description, and quite honestly, the capital pension tax treatment makes absolutely no sense to me. So I was a tax economist in the government, and so I've had lawyers explain tax law to me, and they explained it perfectly, and I said, that makes no sense. So I'm not saying they didn't describe it right, I'm just saying the law doesn't make a whole lot of sense. There seems to be a massive amount of gaming. If your tax, if you get a $59 deduction or 59% deduction going in and you're taxed at 40% on the way out, when those two tax rates aren't the same, you can churn, I mean, you can't churn in these, but 64-year-olds could churn because they get paid out at 65. So in any event, the Denmark situation is a lot different. There's no tax on labor income when it's earned. There's a 15% tax, and it's described as a tax on accruals. Okay, and then there's distributions are taxed as ordinary income if it's an annuity pension, but again, you have this weird treatment for capital pensions. So there's a couple questions about this. So I can model what the benefits are of this, but there's a few issues. How are capital gains taxed outside these plants? Okay, and typically gains are not taxed on accrual; they're taxed on realization. Taxing gains at accrual is a really different tax treatment. And the other thing is, I know if you're in an investment fund. They're called UCITS in Europe. They're different than mutual funds here. Mutual funds here distribute their income. You get taxed on it. They have something called roll-up. So unless you sell the shares, you don't get taxed on dividends and capital gains. So they essentially have deferral in a taxable account. And so what I really like is a better modeling of what the benefits are of these and then how do the benefits change. And for whom do they change? And then, so if we're going to say people aren't responding as we would expect, well, how would we expect them to respond? Because it's not clear to me how I'd expect them to respond. The way I originally modeled it, I don't see why there'd be huge response. But if you model it out, you can actually get a result that says older people should be more sensitive to the subsidy because they had a bigger reduction. The change that took place in 99 reduced their tax benefit more than it reduced the tax benefit for a 20-year-old. And it's because of the length of the deferral issue. And so it makes perfect sense to me that 50-year-olds are much more responsive within a rational model. The other thing I'll say is if people are not, if high-income people are not responding, it certainly would mean that their behavior is not increasing national savings. But it doesn't mean they're irrational. Mr. Gale, before behavioral economics was a gleam in Richard Thaler's eye, had all sorts of arguments of why they're income shifting within a neoclassical model of rational behavior, why IRAs might not increase savings, particularly among the high income. I'd like a better description of is it rational. So I don't think it's like the Danish system is like the U.S. system. It's based on my reading of a few OECD documents, so I could be convinced otherwise. But it seems considerably different. The Danish system, as it's described, seems to me crowds out a whole lot of voluntary savings for a large portion of the population. Now, the study attempts to isolate those not at the corner, and they do lots of efforts. I have some questions of how much they succeed in that. But also, more importantly, is if it doesn't work in Denmark, how does that translate? So let me just finish up with a few. I know I'm probably running out of time. A few thoughts on the U.S. retirement system and how it differs. Okay, so we do have a mandatory system for all. It's Social Security. But Social Security only crowds out saving for people at the low end. Okay, so at the low end, it provides a very high replacement rate as a percent of earnings. But for a large swath of the population, they need to save more than that. Okay, so why would we think savings incentives through a pension plan increase savings? Well, because it gives a marginal incentive to people to save more. There's going to be more people open to a marginal incentive in the U.S. system than in Denmark. Why do people think they don't increase savings? Well, retirement plans, so if you're a conservative economist, you want a consumption tax, so no investment returns are taxed, okay? And you think that will increase savings and will provide a marginal incentive to the entire population. Pensions don't do that. There's caps. There's annual caps on how much you put in. Some people will want to save in excess of that. So the tension in the 401k is how many people are saving more because they do get a marginal incentive, but then we have this cap, and how many of those aren't getting incentive on how much costs and tax subsidies go to them or whatever. So the answer can be a lot different in the U.S. because there's a lot more need for people to supplement Social Security. We then have a voluntary system. Okay, the defined contribution, at least as described in the OECD, is not a voluntary system. I mean, it's voluntary if your labor union agrees to it, and then if you got the job, money's taken away. Compensation set aside for retirement is taxed in retirement. So why do we have deferral in the code? Deferral's certainly been in the code since 1921. It's unclear if it was in before because the laws were not clear. Chances are we've allowed deferral since we put the income tax in. I don't think it was put in to increase national savings. If I wanted to increase national savings, that was my only goal. If I was on the right, I'd put in a consumption tax because that provides marginal incentives to the whole population. If I was on the left, I'd run recurrent budget surpluses, and that would raise national savings. I wouldn't set up the pension system, right? I mean, because, again, it has this weird cap at the top, which obviously does not provide marginal incentives to some portion. So why do we have it? I think, A, we want a system that's a portion mandatory and some part voluntary. And when you have an income tax system that is highly progressive or progressive at all, the reason you're taxing some people more is you think they're better off. Okay, so you want to measure a well-being, and you're going to tax people who are better off more. Okay, annual income is not a great measure of well-being, in my view. Okay, and particularly if your income is coming from earnings, because most of us won't work every year of our lives, so it may not be a good indication of our permanent income. Okay, so there are reasons why you want to tax someone with $100,000 of wages differently than someone with $100,000 of interest from treasuries. Coupons on treasuries, okay? And so what you may want to allow them to do is take some of their income and defer tax into retirement and then pay tax then. I had a paper that I hope to have out by now, but I had to learn about the Danish system. But when I look at this and you simulate it, I think there's all sorts of evidence that deferral is a very fair way to tax. You have to have compensation to defer. You can't defer other types of income. Now, if you have other savings, you can shift it, obviously. It lowers taxes while you're working. It raises taxes while you're retired. The net effect actually isn't as big as you may think. And I think it leads to a much more fair system. And I also think in the United States, the evidence suggests that it probably does increase savings. But if you prove to me it didn't, that's not why I think it's in the code. It's a fair way to tax. You allow people to defer some of their earnings until they need it. So I'll stop there.
Well, thanks very much. The disadvantage of being me, on this occasion, there's many disadvantages of being me, but the particular disadvantage of being me this morning is following up on a great presentation and some very interesting comments. So the downside is that many of the smart things I was going to say have already been said, and many of the dumb things I'm just going to say you don't want to hear. So I'm just going to try to run through, and I anticipated a little bit of this, so I can cut out quite a bit of it, and the advantage of that would be hopefully more time for your questions and responses from the authors, which I think will be great. So I'm going to talk a little bit more some qualitative issues. You're sort of, just to frame things, your conventional wisdom in all this is, you know, A, Americans need to save more, particularly savings for retirement. B, government policy should encourage that saving. Since I'm a libertarian, I like to say B, that actually is a legitimate question. And C, the tax preference for retirement saving like 401ks will actually help in doing that. Now, I'm not actually a super strong proponent of assumption A, that we have this retirement saving crisis and things like that. I know there's a certain amount of material out there. The claims were all at risk of inadequate saving. Some of the work that I did when I was at Social Security and some subsequent work, I think, indicates that, you know, there are certainly people who need to save more, but really there's a lot of – I tend to think it's a well-intentioned argument but somewhat overblown. And I think in particular, I mean, if you're thinking about national saving, I think in particular it may be overblown. I mean, the evidence indicates there's a relatively small number of people who've undersaved by a kind of relatively small amount. And, you know, so from the focus of, you know, federal government policy, the time we're running trillion-dollar deficits and, you know, massive underfunding of entitlements, when we think about our problems with national saving, I'm not sure retirement saving is actually the biggest problem. You know, at the same time, though, we want to get policy right. You know, I think there's reasons to think why the incentives we have currently in the tax code for retirement saving may not work. You know, your standard sort of stuff, the behavioral economic stuff that you read in, like, you know, New York Times Magazine or whatever, you know, they like to say all the conventional wisdom of neoclassical economics is all wrong. You know, people, their brains work differently and all that sort of stuff. You know, and partly that may be true. There's also the issue of just, you know, figuring out how these tax incentives work. They're complicated. It's costly in terms of time of gathering information. Your average person, you know, doesn't have any clue what marginal tax rate they're in. So just processing of saying, you know, what is it worth to me to do this? Because it's not a tax deduction, a tax deferment. I suspect a lot of people, it's not that they're they'd be incapable of responding to a well-designed incentive. They just have an incentive that's not particularly well-designed. It's very, Peter's comments aside, it's just very tough for people to process this kind of stuff. So I can easily believe that people are not responding to the incentives that we have in place. And even to the degree that this stuff matters, we've got the issue of because it's done through the tax code, we've got a progressive income tax, you're giving the largest incentives to high-income people who are probably going to save anyway. You're giving very little incentives to low-income people who are presumably the ones who need to save. So, you know, it's stuff like this that sort of restores my lack of confidence in Washington, where it's just, you know, we have things just completely, you know, I used to say when I was at SSA that it's ass backwards, literally in terms of spelling, but, you know, it's some of the stuff you say, you could do a little bit better than this. Broadly speaking, you know, I buy the results. I mean, I think, you know, Peter raises some good points. I think in terms of thinking about the roles of the sort of the mandatory pensions, the author made the point that the personal saving rate appears to be the same between the U.S. and Denmark. But if you've got a sort of a more generous or pension plan in Denmark than the U.S. versus Social Security, that stuff doesn't really show up. I mean, it's sort of implicit saving by individuals in terms of the benefit they're going to get from the government, and they should alter their saving, their personal saving based on it. But that kind of I'm not a total expert on the national accounts, but those things are done on a sort of a cash basis. So that kind of implicit saving, the accruals within sort of Social Security type programs aren't really going to show up that well. So I think there is the issue of, you know, what from the, and I think this gets to Peter's point, how much should these folks actually be saving? I've argued that I'm not sure people are really undersaving by that much in the U.S. Peter made a good point of, you know, why is anybody saving in Denmark? So I think it's a kind of a point to sort of grapple with in all that. Maybe to touch on some of the interesting, I mean, it was a good presentation, so a lot of things I thought they wouldn't mention, they did. So it leaves me with some of the sort of ancillary points to hit on. One point that I think was nice that they made in the paper, which they didn't really mention here, is that the higher saving you get when you either sort of mandated saving or when people switch jobs, that higher saving doesn't tend to wash out over time. You know, I can easily imagine that we did, say, auto enrollment in 401ks, that saving would increase because people won't really pay that much attention, but after a while they learn what's going on and then they would adjust and optimize their saving rates. It appears from the paper that's not what happens. If you revisit their saving rates, you know, several years later, they're still on this autopilot path. That, from the perspective of their classification of you know, most or 85% of people being passive savers, that team seems to support that supposition, and it also seems to support the policy idea of things like auto enrollment and pension accounts, that people they're not going to wise up and sort of undo it later. But I think there's another sort of thing, another kind of margin to think about on all this, is that what we're looking at in terms of the mandated saving, that was 1% of pay, even the increase in saving we're getting through the job switchers, you're focused on folks, 3% or more. If we really have a big retirement saving problem in the U.S., you're going to want to do bigger sort of mandated or auto enrollment saving rates than 1% or 2% or 3%. If the problem is as big as we say it is or as big as we read it is, you're going to want to do 5% or 10% of pay, something like that. And so even if they don't wise up over time and adjust their saving, they may wise up as the saving rates get larger, that the response you get from a 1% mandatory saving rate may be different than what you get from 5% or 10%. At that point, they may really notice a reduction in their take-home pay and their consumption possibilities. They may adjust based on that. I'm not sure exactly how you could test in the data. One way you could think about it would be to look at offsets, say, for lower-income folks versus higher-income people. For a low-income person, 1% of their pay is going to be more salient to them. It's going to matter to them more than for the high-income person. You could think in those ways of, are you getting are the low-income folks offsetting a little bit more? But that leads into a second interesting point they hit on, which in a sense may answer that question, is we get this concern with things like auto enrollment or mandatory saving. Can low earners afford to save? And I think the argument from that was, if you're forcing them to save, you're putting the undue hardship. The results seem to be here is that when you're signing folks up for mandatory saving, even the low-income folks are not offsetting that. They're not reducing their saving elsewhere. And I think that gets over one of these sort of quasi-moral questions we have about mandatory saving. Are you imposing hardships on low earners that they can't really afford to take? And it appears that may not be the case. Let's try to skip over. I think they did focus or talk a little bit about this in the presentation, and is thinking of the sort of the effects of the tax preferences at different kinds of margins. To save, a person needs first the opportunity to save for retirement, then they need the inclination. The focus here has been kind of on the inclination. We present incentives to people. How do they respond to those incentives? That's contingent on them having the opportunity to save through a pension account. One of the sort of the downsides of benefits policy is the policy is made by the people who are in the room at the time. And those tend to be the higher earning employees, the long tenure employees, the ones who are involved in policy making within the firm. In some sense, that can lead to bad results. Say, in the public sector, you have a lot of defined benefit pensions, which are really, really good for the long-term employees, which may not be good for short and medium-term employees. But in this case, the tax preference for DC pensions, the private sector, may work to the advantage. That even if those high-income folks who are setting the policy, it may just be a pure transfer to those guys. They're not altering their behavior at all. But the one thing they are altering is offering a pension plan within the firm so that they can get the benefits of that tax preference. Because of non-discrimination rules, it's harder for them to offer it just for themselves and not to the low earners, so that the tax preference could encourage the availability of pension plans, even if it doesn't change the saving rate very much. Now, I agree that there's some tax credit or gas mandate we could use to get around this. It does seem to be a I don't have a good idea in my head of what the net cost of the retirement savings tax deferral is, but it does seem to be a fair amount to spend just to encourage greater availability. So there may be other ways to get around that. Skipping. Okay. One final point, so I can wind it up and get you guys to Q&A, is the classic is every paper ends up by saying more research is needed, which is usually a way of saying more research funding is needed. But But I think, you know, more research is needed. I'd like to make two points to wind up. One is on data. And, you know, what makes this paper possible, what makes it really so compelling is they've got a really neat data set that you don't really have here in the U.S. And, you know, some of that's just you know, there's – if you're somebody who's concerned with privacy, I'm not sure Denmark is exactly the place you want to live. I mean, but still, if you're a researcher, you're like, I got to get my hands on this. I mean, we know, you know, what they majored in college, what they studied. I mean, it's a little bit Orwellian, but from the research standpoint, it's great. We're never going to get that here in the U.S. But at the same time, on the data front, we have here things like, say, the American Community Survey – is, you know, there's threats to that because of privacy issues and all that. Things like the National Compensation Survey, parts of that have been scaled back for funding issues. And, you know, I may be the token conservative, but, you know, I'm all for gutting the government and all that, but you don't start with the eyes and ears. If you want to make good policy, you really do need good data, because otherwise you're just making policy by anecdote. So I think one of the lessons from this is if these results hold, they tell you something very important about the policy we're doing here in the U.S., tax policy towards retirement saving. If Denmark didn't have this kind of data, we wouldn't know these answers. So there's a point here that data is worthwhile to have, and it's worthwhile for folks to support. Just following on that, and just to think about, I guess to close, you know, if you're thinking of, well, what further research can we do? Well, in the U.S. here, I mean, the value of, you know, I made the point earlier, the value of a tax preference depends on your marginal tax rate. And, you know, luckily for research purposes, we've just raised marginal tax rates. So even here in the U.S., among very high earners, the folks who are going to be the top tax rates, I'm guessing there's a fair number of those folks who are not maxing out their pension contributions. It's just, you know, there's a lot of variation there. It would be interesting to take a look over the next couple of years and say, you know, have they respond to the fact that when you're, you know, I don't know exactly how it'll play out. I mean, if you top tax rate to 39 and the pet peeves, stuff like that, you know, it becomes significantly more valuable to shield your income from taxation over the next couple of years than it was over the past decade or so. Are people going to respond to that by saving more in their IRAs or 401ks? Just 401ks are the IRAs they won't be eligible for. But it's something, I think it'll be an interesting kind of research standpoint to look at, and it might give you some further clues in terms of how people really respond to this. You know, policy changes are not always great in terms of, you know, their impact on individuals. You don't want uncertainty and all that. At the same time, though, if you want to find out how they react to policy, having a policy change is a good way to go. So I'm going to wind it up there because I'm sure you guys have a lot of questions and want to get into that. But I just say it's just a neat paper, and I think it's a real contribution to the work in this area. Thanks very much.
Let me take this opportunity to thank Abby Major, who organized the whole conference and made everything run so smoothly. So, Abby, I don't – oh, there you are. Thank you very much. The main lesson that you should have taken from the last hour and a half is that if you want it to be if you want a 95% replacement rate, or you want to be happy or taller, you should move to Denmark. So let's start. Let me start by asking Raj and John if they want to respond to any of the comments that were just made.
Well, great. Well, first of all, I just want to really thank the two discussants for spending most clearly a great deal of time with this paper and with other sources. The paper is long, and so I was thinking of sending some pickled herring in the spirit of the analysis, but we really appreciate your comments. You make a lot of great points and a lot to think about. So there were two things that I just wanted to start out with. So the first thing is that in Peter's excellent discussion, a lot of it focused in terms of these automatic contributions on this government mandate, which was a 1% mandated contribution that the identification comes off some quite low-income individuals. And I think he points out some very clear and correct concerns that you might have with that design. That's part of why we
presented this other design based on employer switches today, I think the more general lesson to follow up on what Andrew was saying is that the value of having data like this is not just that you have the data in the first place, but that there's such richness that you can really dig in and find specific situations in order to deal with lots of different concerns that you might have, right? So the mandate, the identification comes from very low-income people, so we're going to use job switches that apply to higher-income people. Or, you know, the replacement rate might be very high for some low-income people, but we can look at some much, much higher-income people and where that's not as much of a concern. So to specifically then focus in on some of the firm switching and pension details, first, just to kind of clear up what some of the institutional details are. So there is an employer-based, what Peter was called, occupation pension plus the individual pension. And those two things are quite close substitutes in the sense that both are allocated. Individual has choice, but it's very limited choice. It's across kind of a couple of broad-based mutual funds. It's not like you can invest in individual stocks. And then there's a great deal of variation across firms because the collective bargaining in Denmark works in two stages. There's a kind of a grand collective bargaining at the occupation level that sets some very basic parameters, and then individual firms bargain with either unions or workers, whatever the relevant unit is, within that to set differences across firms. So you look in our data and you see a tremendous amount of variation from firm to firm. Not all of them are providing 15% pensions, but there's a lot of variation within occupation, across occupation, and you can kind of cut the firm switches any way you want, and you always get the same type of very, very high pass-through of these employer pensions. And so there are people who look like they really could just offset it very easily who never do. And so that's part of what convinced us that these firm pension changes were first a good source of identification, but second, something that we're having a really first-order impact on not just people's savings, but then people's wealth in retirement.
So just to add briefly to that, and we'd love to hear your comments, so I'll be very brief. And thanks again to you both for your excellent comments. I wanted to clarify two things. So first, while the aggregate statistics, I think, are quite useful in getting a general sense of the institutions in Denmark, they mask the fact, as John was saying, that there's substantial heterogeneity across employers and across individuals. And that's important because it helps you understand why some people are saving quite a bit voluntarily. So the defined benefit social security system, as Peter mentioned, gives you a fixed benefit that declines as your income goes up. And so what that means is for a lot of people, especially higher income folks, replacement rates are actually quite low from the pure defined benefit system. And there are many employers who actually provide very small employer pensions. And so if you don't save anything yourself, you are going to end up with very little income in retirement, just like in the U.S. And what we do in our paper is focus in on subsets of higher income individuals. We weren't able to show you those results today in the interest of time, but you know, focus on individuals for whom the replacement rates are actually substantially lower, and you see very, very similar patterns, which is not terribly surprising because, again, coming back to the theme here, this is about who's paying attention and what fraction of people are passive savers, and that appears to be fairly constant even if your replacement rates are higher or lower. A related point, which Peter raised and I think Andrew also alluded to, is what you can learn from these changes in employer pension plans when you switch jobs. And is that really kind of a good experiment to learn about the impacts of automatic contributions? So I want to make two points there. First, if you focus on a subset of individuals who were, say, part of a mass layoff, so we don't think these people are switching because they want to save more. It's essentially a random event from the perspective of how much you want to save. Even in that subgroup of individuals, we find very similar patterns, which when you switch to a firm that has a bigger employer pension, which makes you think that it's really the causal effect of these pensions. And then coming to the question of whether big changes in pension policy would have similar effects. So we showed you examples of 3% changes in pensions. Turns out that you can look at 5%. There's enough data to go, you know, further out, 5% increases, 6, 7% increases. I have no doubt that if I changed your pension by 50%, you know, you might start to pay attention and wonder why you have half as much money as you did before. But in the range of what I think of as sort of plausible policy variation, it seems like these impacts are actually quite important. The last thing that I want to say is, you know, we can argue, I think, endlessly about whether Denmark is or is not similar to the U.S. And obviously Denmark is not exactly the same as the U.S. And I don't think that's ever going to be a winning argument that these two places are identical. What I think is important is whether this mechanism of active versus passive choice applies in America as it seems to in Denmark. And while I think all the comments made a lot of sense, I didn't see a particular argument for why, because the institutions are different or the people are different or whatever, that the, you know, you'd find a very different rate of passive behavior in the U.S. And as I was saying, that's what it really boils down to. So I think you need to come up with a good argument for why, even though within retirement accounts we do see substantial passive behavior in the U.S., somehow overall the degree of passivity ends up being quite different than what we find in the Danish data.
Great. Thank you. Questions? Let me just ask people to state, Gary, state your name and affiliation, and please be sure you have a question.
Well, it's first a remark and then a question. And
that's surprising.
I'm Gary Burtless. I think it's a brilliant study, and I don't think that there's any doubt that the behavioral economics findings about the whether this carries over to the United States, this lesson about passive versus active undoubtedly carries over to the United States. But another issue is that the United States retirement system has a huge voluntary component, and there's two decision points. The first decision point is the employer's decision to offer a workplace retirement savings plan, and the second is what should I do, what should individual workers do given the retirement savings plans they face. This addresses the second decision point, and it is very possible that in the United States, because our overall retirement system has such a big voluntary component, it's voluntary on the part of employers to offer a retirement savings plan, and in many of those plans it's then voluntary for the worker to make a decision about whether to participate and how much to save. And so the question is, are there some mysteries that are resolved if we think about the incentives in the system as incentives to encourage employers to offer retirement plans and how to structure those retirement plans? And do our tax incentives aim at the particular needs of very high-income people within companies in whose interest the incentives clearly have to be favorable?
So I think the point you make about these two different stages at which decisions need to be made in order to allow people to save for retirement is exactly right. And you're also exactly right that we're only characterizing the individual decision, you know, both the individual decision to contribute and how much to contribute. But because workers have access to tax-deferred pension plans in Denmark without any action by their employer, there's nothing in our data to speak directly to this issue of whether, you know, especially small or medium-sized businesses might drop or not provide the option to workers. Now, that having been said, I think that there are lots of ways that we can provide workers access to these accounts. Even if we stay within the firm, right, it's not that we need firms to actively contribute money to these accounts. All we need is the firm to call up Vanguard and kind of set up an account. So that doesn't cost that much. And so it's not clear to me that we need to be working through the personal income incentives of, say, the manager or the owner of the business by giving them, say, a 40% tax deduction in order to give all of the workers access, not any money, but just access to these accounts. And so, again, for instance, one option might be that you could interpret the non-discrimination clause instead of saying, well, if the rich guy's going to take advantage of it, then everybody has to take advantage of it. Just say, look, you have to offer access to this thing. Another way that you could do it, as we mentioned briefly at the end of the talk, is, you know, Denmark and many other countries offer access to these types of retirement accounts without going through the employer. And so we have IRAs in this country. I think IRAs have a number of undesirable features, like it's not payroll deductible and there's very low limits on it. But I think there's nothing set in stone about that. And so I think that the way I like to take these results to think about policy is not about whether it means we should change this one very specific aspect of the system in itself or not, but kind of if you were going to go make a reform to the system, kind of in what broad direction would you want to take it? And taking these considerations into account would be very important in that reform.
Pete, do you want to answer?
Yeah, absolutely. So Gary recommended a paper I wrote, Who Gets Pensions and Why, and talk about the incentives to offer it. So it's important to understand, if we're going to say people aren't behaving rationally, we have to define how a rational person would respond. And there's lots of different ways to think about it. But not everyone should be saving for retirement at every point in their life. And actually, if you look at life cycle models of savings and investing, they actually, because most people have hump-shaped earnings, like earnings go up over time, and then the assumption, for non-economists in the room, essentially, to simplify it, people sort of want a smooth consumption over time, that you would actually see people in the simplest models take on debt early, pay it off, and they wouldn't start saving for retirement until their 40s. So that simplest model doesn't include Social Security at all, and since Social Security has a much higher replacement rate for the low income, for at any given age, they would be less likely to desire to save to supplement Social Security. So if you actually analyze the data, well, there's sort of like I'm peeling the onion. We don't have as good a data as Denmark. So the typical data people look at is CPS, the current population survey. There's reasons to believe it undercounts certain things. But if you just accept their measure and you look into it in a little more detail, whether your employer offers a plan has a lot to do with what your characteristics are. Or another way to say it is that firms that offer a plan are different than firms that don't offer a plan. So, for example, size of the firm is very important. But if you then control for whether the employer offers a plan or doesn't offer a plan, so if you look at small firms and big firms, first of all, small firms are not just little big firms. They're quite different. They have different employees. They're much less likely to be full-time, full year, much more likely to be very low-wage earning, much less likely to have higher education, which is correlated with lifetime earnings. And so it's not a random portion of the population that has access to it. And once you control for it, small firms, there's very few small firms that offer a plan, according to the data, but the ones that do have a workforce that looks almost identical to big plans that offer a plan. And then big plans, that the few large employers that don't offer a plan, seem to have workforces that look a lot like most of the small firms that don't offer a plan. They're much lower income, most less likely to be full-time. And so whether your employer offers a plan, it has to do with whether employees sort of are interested in saving for retirement and thus value this tax benefit. And so the question is, why isn't everyone offering it? And in my mind, part of it is non-discrimination rules. Now, this is not an argument against non-discrimination rules. There's benefits within a firm of non-discrimination rules. But what they do is they tie the benefits that a high-paid employee gets to what a low-paid employee gets. Okay? And what that does is if the majority of your workforce is not interested in saving for retirement, doesn't value deferred income, they're not going to be willing to reduce their wage in return for this pension benefit. And so and you can't just offer a 401k. If they're not contributing, then high paids can't contribute, so no one benefits, even though it costs money to put up. So what may help is some sort of plan, maybe that doesn't have employer contributions or other things, that doesn't have these non-discrimination rules and allows people to do it. But I think part of why you're seeing firms don't offer it, if your low paids are very low paid, they make under 20 grand and they're part-time, you're not going to offer a plan. If your low paids are engineers making 90 grand, you will offer a plan. And that's what you see in the data.
Let me just follow up on that. There seems to be a subtext to this discussion about employer-provided pensions, that employers provide pensions out of the largesse of their hearts, and we need to basically bribe them by giving high tax deductions to their executives to offer the pensions. But the data that Pete offered, I think, offers a different message, which is that pensions, 401ks in particular, are part of a competitive pay package. And firms don't pay wages out of the goodness of their heart. They pay because that's what the market requires. And that argument would say that firms, you know, are going to offer 401ks because that's part of a competitive pay package. And if they don't, people will find other firms more attractive and go there. So I'm not sure how much we have to pay off the owners of especially big firms via huge income tax deductions. They may say, oh, we're not going to offer a pension if you don't give us our full tax deduction. But that doesn't mean they won't offer a pension any more than they say, well, we might cut wages if you change the taxation of wages. I mean, they all operate in a competitive marketplace. So I think we need to look at the sort of the competitive optimizing reactions, not just what they say.
But, all right, let's clear up
30 seconds.
Okay, well, the biggest incentive to save does not go to the people with the highest marginal tax rates. Okay? The biggest incentive to save in a qualified plan versus a taxable plan goes to people with the top marginal tax rates because we tax the hell out of their savings in the taxable account. Okay? What deferral does, assuming tax rates don't change, is give everyone the same after-tax rate of return, which is the pre-tax rate of return. So the incentive to save is how much can I consume tomorrow versus today, which is my after-tax rate of return. And what deferral does is give everyone the same after-tax rate of return and give everyone the same incentive to save.
All right. Jason.
Hi, Jason Fichtner with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. And one of the things that Andrew and I have sort of shared being at Social Security is an understanding of the data. And while Andrew doesn't see necessarily a retirement crisis, I do see a retirement concern. And one of them is basically he looks at the idea of the people who get Social Security, especially the low-income earners, they have a high replacement rate. And for them, that is their forced savings, and Pete mentioned that as well. If you look at data and research that Dallas Salisbury has done, sort of rules of thumb of how much you might need in retirement to be comfortable. Someone making $50,000 a year needs $1 million and they retire. If you use that measurement, a lot of us are going to have retirement insecurity. I am concerned with the incentive structure we have with our tax code. One of the policy forms you did not mention is turning our current deductibility of retirements of income from deferral, as Pete mentions, to something like a credit, where the incentives would be more in favor for lower income people to save if we gave them a tax credit than a deduction, so it's not top heavy and you turn it around. And maybe Andrew and Pete could also say, is that a better way to do an incremental change to our current tax structure? It allows for deferral, but it gives a credit for lower-income people so that they have a better incentive to save than higher-income people right now.
Let me collect a couple more comments. Dallas, you had a question there? Hank?
My question is how this bears on what we know about the interest sensitivity or yield sensitivity of savings. The story you're telling is basically it's zero. And so my question is, if your objective is to promote saving inexpensively, what exactly is your policy suggestion? Is it withdrawing all current advantages and somehow taking the step that Gary suggested to make sure that saving is available, but in principle, I think one could take it even further, because you're raising a real question about whether saving responds to yield at all. And I'd be curious about your reaction on that.
Okay. Let's take one more question, David John.
I'm David John, the Heritage half of Retirement Security Project. I'm actually intrigued with your policy recommendations, and I want to clear up a question there. Are you recommending that all tax incentives for savings be reduced or eliminated, or are you recommending that only those for people above a certain income level be reduced? And the question is whether there is still a value to them below a certain level.
All right, so we have three questions. Deductions to credits, yield sensitivity of saving and the policy implications, and then we're looking at restricting saving incentives for high income or all households. Why don't we start with you first?
Okay, so let me take the interest elasticity one first. So
That's a great observation. So another way to state our results is basically when you change marginal interest rates here through changing tax incentives on these retirement accounts, you don't change the net amount that people are saving. So correct inference from that is that the interest elasticity of savings is very low or very close to zero. Now, there are two reasons for that in the data. One is a large fraction of people are not actually paying attention to the change in tax incentives. So that's going to produce what appears to be a low interest elasticity. But then even among the 15% who do pay attention, the total amount they save doesn't respond that much to the tax incentive. So I think you're totally right in making that point. Now, one important caveat to extrapolating from this to yield elasticities more generally is you are talking about a set of people here who are on the margin of saving for retirement, not saving tremendous amounts of money, right? So for instance, suppose I change the capital gains tax or the dividends tax. The aggregate impacts on national saving are going to largely come from some people who are saving way more than the amounts in these retirement accounts. And I would not be surprised at all if those elasticities are actually considerably larger. But that's a different domain, different from the retirement savings issue that we're tackling here.
So I was going to actually respond to the other two questions, which are somewhat related, which is that if you move from our current system of deductibility to some other system, whether it be credits or whether it's some subsidy that changes in some other way with respect to income, kind of what would the alternative be? And I think that if you the direction in which our results point is that you don't really need a subsidy in order to encourage people to save more. But what the subsidy might be worthwhile to do is compensate people for some of the other features of retirement accounts that we think do encourage not just saving for retirement, but to make sure that the saving actually makes it all the way to retirement. So, for instance, 401ks and other accounts, they're not highly liquid. You have to pay a penalty in order to get it out, which I think it's both the penalty and the bunch of forms you have to fill out that is going to keep people from doing that quite so easily. And so it's perfectly possible that in order to put up with that, you know, you recognize up front that this is a good deal, but, you know, it's not a good deal if it's for nothing. And so some kind of incentive to compensate people for this might be a good idea. If that's what we're trying to provide the incentive for, then I think the rationale for what kind of incentives you need to provide, whether a credit or how it relates to income, is how this how does the incentive need to vary in order to encourage people to save in these slightly illiquid forms? And so my guess is that you don't need to scale it all the way up to the current level of the marginal tax rate, but, you know, some type of small credit, or, you know, maybe there's an argument that richer people value the liquidity more. You could argue that poorer people value the liquidity more because they're the ones that might actually need to get at it. So I think that's how you'd want to – I don't have a specific answer for you, but I think that's how you'd want to think this through, not necessarily just based on the income tax system.
Okay, I'm supposed to keep it short, so I'll keep it short. I have a paper on this. The incentive – the benefit of deferral is not the same as the benefit of an exemption or deduction. Deferral is not an exemption or deduction. It's a deferral of tax. That doesn't mean it's better or worse. It's like my kids. They're just different, okay? And so a lot of things matter. So the benefit isn't the upfront deduction. So if you want to limit it, don't attack the upfront deduction because you get all sorts of strange effects. Okay. So, for example, if you do a 15% flat credit, it sounds like, well, you still get a good deal. Well, it turns out if you're invested in stocks and you're in the top marginal tax rate, you got to defer for like 35 years before it's better off to save in a deferral account than a taxable account because the benefit isn't the upfront deduction. Okay, all the upfront deduction is paid off when you take it out, assuming your rate doesn't go down. The benefit is a deferral. Right? Okay, well, if the rate goes down, then there's more benefit. I would say that makes the tax code more progressive because whose rate goes down? Well, people don't have a lot of that are don't want to be too personal, but say someone who's born to the world with nothing but human capital, and so in retirement is going to have a whole lot less income because they don't have annual capital every year, and so you actually get a better measure of lifetime well-being if those tax rates go down. If you're really rich, your tax rates aren't going to go down. So I don't have a problem with tax rates going down.
Yeah. Just very, very quickly, Jason's comment on should we essentially give a savings credit rather than thinking about the auto enrollment. I'm kind of skeptical. I mean, and this is going back a bit. I mean, Olivia Mitchell did some work looking at responsiveness to match rates. for employer pensions. It showed it wasn't huge. There's also other stuff looking at, you know, people leaving money on the table in terms of people have the opportunity to sort of churn their retirement accounts and just generate a benefit. They don't do it. So I mean, I think part of the lesson is, you know, the $20 bill does sometimes sit on the sidewalk for a while. I just tend to think from the policy standpoint the automatic enrollment was just way, since there's no bucks involved, it's way better bang for your buck.
Okay, let me just say, if people can't make these decisions and aren't influenced for rational decision making, by all means, it's much better to mandate. Okay, so if you don't think people have the ability to decide when to start saving, how much to save, and where to take it out, certainly don't set up that system. Okay, I see no evidence in the aggregate data that people are making massive mistakes in getting to retirement unprepared. Okay, so before we have a massive government intervention in how people allocate their consumption over their lifetime, and the central government decides how that happens, we should have some evidence of a market failure before we have that massive government intervention.
Okay, let's see. We have time for one short question, if anyone wants to, or we can. Julia.
Okay. So, I, similarly along the veins of the other commentators, I'm going to give you my policy takeaways and would like to hear your view. So, the first one is tantalizing in an era of budget deficits, which is we can eliminate this tax expenditure, and it would not really hurt anybody, except for some higher income people, and it wouldn't change retirement security at all. And that's great news, so let's do that. And bring in $100 billion a year. So is that your takeaway? And that's sort of independent of the second takeaway, which is the auto enrollment and mandatory accounts. And I'm not really sure exactly where you guys are standing on that. Are you advocating mandatory accounts? Are you advocating sort of more maybe a sort of general set of preferred principles for 401ks that feature auto enrollment? And why aren't we, if we're talking about, you know, this retirement security issue and the fact that, you know, you have these passive people and maybe there is an issue about retirement security, why is it always about the 401ks and not about, well, maybe we shouldn't be taking on as much consumer and student loan debt while you're young? Maybe you should have feature in paying off your mortgage as part of your retirement plan. It's always around the 401k system or mandatory individual accounts. And we know there's so many problems. There's administrative costs, job switching. There's what is your default from an employer's perspective? What is your liability when you recommend 60% stock allocations and stocks fall 50%, which we know happens. So there's a lot of issues in designing a system. You noted that this literature goes back 30 years, and I think I've been involved in it for roughly that period of time. And we have been talking about mandatory accounts for just that length of time, and you guys are young, eager whippersnappers, and it's this is a brilliant paper, and you're fantastic presenters, it actually makes me want to read all 72 pages of this.
Great.
But, you know, what about the broader retirement picture, and why aren't we talking about, you know, the well-being issues and the debt? For God's sakes, the rise in consumer debt coincided with the rise in the 401k system because we're incentivized to leverage and shovel our liquidity into the 401k system rather than just not taking on the debt.
All right, let's give the authors the last word here and solve all of our problems, please.
Yeah. So I think your question highlights what a number of other people have sort of suggested, which is we haven't come here with like a well-defined policy proposal that this is, you know, what we should do. This is what we've shown you what we think the data are revealing in terms of the impacts of these subsidies and automatic enrollment policies. On the issue of can you take away the tax expenditure and have no impact, I mean, what we're showing is that, say, capping the deduction at some level would not have a substantial impact on the total level of savings. Whether going to zero would have a substantial impact or not, it's harder to know. Are some people going to get hurt? Well, I mean, if you were saving a lot in these accounts and getting a big subsidy, of course you are going to lose a significant amount of money. So I don't think you can view it as, you know, from a national perspective, total savings don't end up changing much. From that perspective, it seems like a policy move in the right direction. But of course, individual people may lose or gain. In terms of the automatic enrollment policies, again, I mean, I think the key idea here is if you many firms in the U.S. already have a number of policies of this type, right? And our main point is that those policies do, in fact, raise total savings. So if the government were to try to encourage the use of more such policies, either directly or by giving firms an incentive, we think that would have a significant impact on national savings. There are all these other concerns you mentioned about why not tackle debt, why not use other instruments. Those are totally fair. A broader policy analysis might incorporate policies that would tackle those issues as well.
Stepping back, it seems like, so I know Peter's expressed a more of a fairness-based justification, but certainly a lot of people justify the deduction for contributions, or more generally the tax advantage, as a way of encouraging people to save more. And that takes for granted that we do want to get people to save more. So if your view is that we don't want to get people to save more, then we can just kind of scrap the whole thing. We don't have to worry about it.
Saving is just what you're not spending.
Right, but if your goal is to actually encourage people to save more without, you know, mandating how much exactly they have to save and spend in each period, another way of looking at these mandatory account or these default settings or these employer contributions in Denmark is that if I pay you $100 in a wage, you're going to go out and spend $90 of it. Whereas if I pay you $100 and put it in a pension plan instead, you're only going to spend about $10 of it. And so that's a way, on the flip side, of, you know, if we think what we need to do is cut back the consumption of people when they are younger, and in order to increase the amount that's around for them to consume when they're older, I think that these types of default plans are a more effective way of encouraging that switch than the subsidies.
All right. Let me thank the authors of discussants and all of you for your questions and participation. Thank you very much.